Welcome to For the Medical Record, a podcast brought to you by the Johns Hopkins Center for Medical Humanities and Social Medicine with your hosts. I am Antoine Johnson.
And I'm Christy Slobogan. And today we are interviewing Dr. Jeremy Green, who is the William H. Welch Professor of Medicine and the History of Medicine here at Hopkins. He's an MD, PhD, so he's both a practicing physician and a historian. And his first two books are called Prescribing by Numbers, Drugs and the Definition of Disease, and Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine. Those are from 2007 and 2014. And then his new book that just came out is called The Doctor Who Wasn't There, Technology, History, and the Limits of Telehealth.
Yes. So during this conversation, we discussed a lot, including your favorite, the medical humanities, as well as Dr. Green's new book, The Doctor Who Wasn't There. We also could get a sneak peek into his next project, which is emerging out of discard studies on disposability and what happens with the medical technology when we don't know what to do with it once it's no longer useful.
Yeah, so we're really excited about this conversation. It intersects the history of medicine with a lot of different fields and shows kind of how diverse our field is, which is awesome.
Yes. Let us know what you think. Leave a review and we'll catch you at the tail end of our conversation.
Thanks for listening.
Howdy, howdy.
Thank you so much for joining us on For the Medical Record. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me here.
Always a pleasure. Mm-hmm. Jumping right into it, could you tell us about how you came to be a historian of medicine?
Yeah, I don't have a really straight and fully intelligible story about it. I can tell you that it seemed like it was unlikely to happen and that history was my least favorite subject by far in high school, right? And I don't want to blame my teacher. It's just the way the whole thing was taught. It was, you know, names and dates and military events. And, you know, it just seems like of all the ways of learning things, like the least interesting mode, right, of analysis. And so I was super excited about all kinds of learning coming to college and didn't want to have to declare whether I was interested in the humanities or interested in the natural sciences, right? Like I was looking for a way to combine them. And I saved history for the last possible course requirement before graduating. And then it was actually a course on the history of science. And it's a course on the history of epistemology and how we know what we know and how contingent that knowledge structure is and how embedded it is within social contexts. And not only did that help me realize that history itself was fascinating as a mode of encountering the world, but also made me interested in medicine. So I had been a biology major, but not a pre-med. And it was only by coming to terms with medicine, with healthcare, with caregiving as a way into the complexities of understanding the social world that sort of history then helped me become interested in becoming a physician.
That's so interesting because our last episode with Lan, they had basically the same answer as in they weren't interested in history for the exact same reasons. And then you just find the right way into it.
Yep.
And voila.
And I'm the same way. I couldn't stand history. Like you said, memorization and regurgitation, names and dates.
I always loved it, but I guess I'm an outlier here.
Well, you gotta wonder, like listening to both of you saying this, right? It's like, when you tell someone you're a historian, what does that make them think about you based on their own personal experience? And some people are immediately interested in it, like love thinking historically, but sometimes it can mean a hobby. Like, this is what I do in my spare time. I research this. Isn't it great that you have a job in which you can be doing a hobby all the time? And then, you know, we have to push back on that, right? I do love what I do, but it's not a hobby, right?
Still work. Yeah, right. Very much work. The fun thing being an art historian is that you tell somebody that and they're like, oh my gosh, my favorite artist is this, you know, random Russian artist from the early 20th century. Do you know their work? And I'm like, well, that has nothing to do with what I work on. And maybe I've heard of this person before, but it doesn't mean that I know all
artists who've walked the earth.
Yeah, it's a very silly thing. I also recently missed the one art history question in a pub trivia the other week. And I was so disappointed in myself.
one of these strange things about how expertise works. You always know your limitations and your fallibility and the small portion of the universe of knowledge that you think you have a reasonable grip on, right? But then your expertise is often coming from outside, which is to say the other people on your trivia team that brought you in as the art history ringer, right? So your accountability is really to them, right? But I feel like my goal as a historian in a medical campus, right? It's not to, I think we have these fallacies of this kind of two cultures world in which we believe there are spaces for humanities and spaces for sciences. Or many people who do history of medicine may think, well, they're working against a kind of a caricature of a medical world that only thinks in terms of, you know, biomedical universal scientific formulations. But there's so many spaces of interest and engagement with history, or like a desire for thinking about a social world, that history forms a really important bridge that actually gives quite a bit to folks working within clinical medicine, public health, basic sciences, that in starting out without seeing a false divide that isn't really there, that you wind up opening up these spaces for engagement. But I think it's key too that I'm not trying to make everyone into a historian, right? Because I still don't understand exactly how I came to be a historian. It's more that history is a way of approaching, like, a historical sensibility, right, is something I think anybody can benefit from. And so my goal when I'm working with medical students or public health students or people in health policy is not to try to get them to join the American Historical Association, right, or like step into our PhD program here, although some of them do sometimes, right? But it's just say like, hey, well, what is it that thinking historically can do for you? And how does it open up spaces? And what can we do as historians to help more people think with contingency, right? To think historically and to see the limitations of our present day view of the world.
You helped us with a perfect segue into our next question.
Yeah, perfect segue.
Yeah, just thinking through how your historical practice relates to your work as an MD and vice versa.
So I don't know if I could do either part of my job without the other. You know, I mentioned briefly before that I became interested in becoming a doctor through history, right? Through understanding medicine and the clinical space, the clinical encounter, as this extraordinarily, like, fortuitous, privileged, just remarkable space to actually share, if briefly and imperfectly, a social world with another person, and then with another person, and with many, many people. And so that in any given week, my clinic is a site of exposure and engagement with many people's lives who otherwise I might not have any knowledge of or have anything to do with. So the clinic in that sense is somewhat of an ethnographic site. But I think a lot of ethnographers, a lot of anthropologists have this problem that their research might be seen as extractive, right? And yet the clinic is a site in which ideally and hopefully I can help dedicate myself to each single person one-on-one I have an interaction with to act as an advocate, justify the presence in their life that they allow me, right? Justify my presence in their life with a commitment to work with them to help with, you know, a substantial existential problem that brings them in. So in a sense, the clinic is an ethnographic space. It's a space in which I feel continuously amazed that people are willing to let me in to their very private selves or very private lives, but also grounds in a sort of a pragmatic sense of what it is, what forms of advocacy I might bring one person at a time. So in the clinic, I just constantly find problems emerging, and they're problems of the taken for granted, right? So they're elements of the everyday world that just aren't working. And then that question for the historian becomes, well, why is it that we accept this thing, whether it is the price of a brand name drug or the failure of being able to access a generic drug for something like insulin that doesn't exist, or whether it's the lack of coverage for mental health care, whether it's the challenge of actually trying to help understand why a certain regimen is just inaccessible for a certain population of patients that the system simply hasn't been designed for. And so the clinic is constantly presenting problems of the power dynamics in everyday things that get naturalized in our world. And then history offers a tool to show the sequence of events by which these things came into existence and the story and the power and the politics in their making, and then offer the possibility of destabilizing and asking what can we change and how and why.
I think that was a great answer. And I, you know, what you were saying earlier about kind of a false dichotomy between science and the humanities, it's almost like there's a false dichotomy within the question that we posed, you know, between the MD side of you and the historian side, which I think is good to keep in mind.
But Chrissy, I think I'm going to give you a biased perspective on why there are certain kinds of history where it helps to be in the clinic, not because you need the MD, right? But because it helps to be grounded in elements of what, you know, the questions can emerge. Yeah, like I think all of the books that I've written come from questions that sort of bugged me in the back of my mind week by week in clinic and then turned into research questions. But I think that there's a whole way of doing history of medicine that involves staying as far away from the clinic as you can, because you might say, well, look at how biased I am, right? I'm thoroughly socialized into the world of medicine, right, as a practitioner. And so there are critical questions about medicine as a whole that I don't even think to ask, right? Because I'm so much in the system, right? So on the one hand, there's taking apart the structure of power from within that I can do because I'm part of the system. But I'm really grateful also that there's historians that are just in history departments, like at arm's length from medical schools, that are doing excellent work because they're actually outside of it.
So don't get offended the next time you're in the department and I call you segue.
Yeah, very good segues. But you mentioned how the books that you've written, some of these questions have come from your experience in the clinic. And the reason that we wanted to have you on now is because your book, The Doctor Who Wasn't There, just came out. And so we were wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how you arrived at the topic of that book. If you could give us a little mini synopsis of kind of what The Doctor Who Wasn't There is looking at. And then, you know, if that relates as well to your experiences as a doctor, as a physician, that'd be great. That's like three questions rolled into one, but.
So, you know, I'm delighted to have this book out in the world, The Doctor Who Wasn't There, Technology, History, and the Limits of Telehealth. And it might seem at first that this is a history of telemedicine, and especially as so many of us in the past few years, especially in the cataclysm of the COVID pandemic, have become engaged with telemedicine, right? As patients or as providers or, you know, in my case, certainly as both, it seems a timely topic. But the research started for me well before the pandemic. And it started when I actually started my job here at Hopkins about a decade ago. And I realized that I was sort of shifting. Right? When I started in medical school, I worked in a community health center in which all of the patient charts were these manila envelopes, right, with these sort of different colored stickers on them for the letters of folks' names. And I would write all of my notes by hand. And there was computer systems to look up certain data, right? And then I would have to write a code, but everything was sort of still on paper. And the code was a diagnostic code for the visit. And then when I was in my residency and in my first faculty position in Boston, there was an electronic medical record where I would basically type in, you know, what happened during a patient's visit, type in the note. So it was a digital chart now. But I could type whatever I wanted to. But at the end of the day, in order for that file to actually, you know, be saved or tagged with something, I had to write in a code. And that was the ICD-9 code, this abstract diagnostic code that would be linked to, like, what was the diagnosis of this visit in this sort of algorithmic sense. But then when I started at Hopkins, there was a new computer system for me. And I couldn't finish writing a note without all of these codes being in place. And then gradually, the software will now actually tell me the words that I can and can't use as I type them. You know, I was in clinic last week trying to close out a note and I didn't like an abbreviation that I used. And so I couldn't actually sign the note until I actually wrote in a syntax that the software actually liked. And so that's just a kind of a short history of this in my own relatively brief medical career, watching this medium in which we do, you know, medical care, you know, transform from paper to digital. And also realizing a lot of other clinicians and patients were sort of aware of this transformation, many of them very, very frustrated. I mean, shortly after I started here, I remember talking to someone in the medical residency program. It was July and the new residents shift in June. And I was asking him how things were going with the medical residency program. And he said, well, you know, it's they're going pretty well. Usually about this time, I can recognize all of the interns by the back of their heads. You know, by which he means that they're all sitting there at computer terminals, right, staring at the terminal, and yet the most visible portion, right, is the back of the head. And so realizing that medicine, that the clinical world was going through kind of an awkward media shift, right, kind of like a fish that had been used to swimming in water and that had been sort of hooked and then found itself like, you know, hauled up into the air and suddenly aware of the fact that it had been in water doing just fine for a while. And was now like awkwardly in this new medium. And there's all kinds of reporting on physician burnout related to electronic medical record systems. There's all these putative benefits, right? And hopefully, you know, the two of you have found some benefits through abilities to, say, access your MyChart information, get a quicker sense of your results, and have them be moved back and forth between your providers. But there's all this angst as well about what's being lost in that space, too. Which is just to say, living through this media shift in medicine and living with all of these promises of how, what the Internet of Things and wearable devices and Fitbits and Amazon Halos are going to be giving us in this smart connected world allowed me to, as a historian, ask, well, this can't be the first time that we've been conscious of the promise of electronic media in healthcare. And scratching on it a little bit, found that there was this whole exuberant history of telemedicine, you know, related to cable television, which was supposed to be the internet of the 1970s. And then if you scratch back before that, you realize that sort of networked computers from the 1950s, right, had all of this promise of instantaneous knowledge transfer that never quite came to pass. They did change the world of healthcare, but not in the ways that anyone either hoped or feared. If you go back beyond that, that wireless medical devices are as old as the radio itself. And some of them worked, and the ones that worked well, we don't even think about as medical devices anymore, right? Like the doctor's pager or the telemetry unit, right? And the ICU, where we don't think of that as a radio technology, but that's how it started. Or dialing back even further, you go back to the telephone itself. And so, you know, you just find just a few years after Alexander Graham Bell does his thing and demonstrates that first phone call, you see medical journals full of this exciting new possibility of how telephone medicine will totally annihilate space and time. And every person anywhere should be able to have access to a specialist in a city just by holding a telephone up to their chest and having their heart literally get listened to through the telephone wires. So somewhere in that structure, right, was realizing, oh, there's a book here. It's recursive, it's cyclical. And yet this is part of what history can offer, is how to look through past cycles, not to say that the present is the same as what came before, but to actually look with continuity and change and see if we can, you know, pierce some of the bubbles of both hype and harm that we live within now.
Thank you so much. Okay, so that was a lot, but we did combine three questions. So it was a lot. But it was succinct. But so the book is, you know, our field. It's obviously a history of medicine, but as you just mentioned, it also intersects significantly with the history of technology. For our audience who may not be familiar with academic spaces, shout out to my dad, who's the biggest fan of the show. You know, those are two separate fields. But what has been your previous experience working at that juncture, and what surprised you about, you know, how these two histories intersected with this project?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. And I'm trying to think this through with your dad in mind, right? What is the history of medicine and what is the history of technology? And I have to admit, it was a while before I realized that I've actually always been a historian of technology, and I didn't quite realize it, right? So that my first book called Prescribing by Numbers, Drugs and the Definition of Disease, and it was about how drugs in their promotion, right, in their uptake, in their actual effects on our bodies, but also in the sort of broader psychic effect and hopes that we put into and sort of marketing magic that gets rubbed off around them, transform what it means to be healthy or sick, or what it means to be a patient, or what our healthcare system is. That's a book I thought I was writing about the history of disease, the transformation of disease, knowledge around health and illness. And then I only in retrospect realized that, well, of course, a pharmaceutical is a technology. And a pharmaceutical is something that is a locus of the creation of all kinds of scientific knowledge as well. So there's a sense here about that there's a separation between these fields of history of medicine being, you know, about care and sick people and institutions and healers, right? And history of science being about experimenters and laboratories, right? Or history of technology being about engineers and the things they make in industries. But the closer you look at it, the harder it really is to separate these spaces. I think all of us interested, you know, find ourselves at this junction of fields. But the question is, how do we learn to think the question that thinking about something as a technology allows us to ask, or the question that thinking about something as a science allows us to ask as well. I was just reading Lewis Sullivan's book, We'll Fight It Out Here, A History of Health Disparities Research, among other things, and about the challenge. And Sullivan was the first dean of Morehouse School of Medicine, and played a pivotal role in getting the federal government on a lot of levels to attend to health disparities, health equity in the United States as a legitimate subject of research. But how long it took to make health disparities research something that was seen as a valid form of NIH funding because it wasn't seen as a science. And now it actually has institute status, right? But it took a long time to get there because of, some sort of preconceived notions of what scientific knowledge production was. So that's just, a longer way of saying that I actually think that these different pieces are really inextricable. But part of what thinking about technology allows us to do is to look at the kinds of things that get built into an everyday thing, right? And say, if we think about a technology as a black box that only engineers can understand, then we actually miss the social and political decisions that get into how that thing is allowed to become the standard in the black box. And we miss the kind of malleability and the kinds of social movements that could still be generated around trying to change the structure of our built world to be, say, a little more equitable, a little more accessible.
As you were talking, I turned to Antoine and I said, okay, is big pharma really just big tech then? Just like a different iteration? Because I'd never thought of pharmaceuticals as a technology in that way. So I think that's a really interesting way of breaking it down.
Yeah. So, what's so interesting is, when we separate them, right, we then say things like, well, where do we have the American interest, intense interest in intellectual property law? Well, it comes from, big tech and big pharma, right? Except, isn't that interest actually the same interest fundamentally, right? Or if we try and understand, well, what is involved in the kind of mystification of the making of something like insulin, right? It's been around for 100 years, and yet we still don't have a robust generic insulin market, right? And, part of the reason behind that is what kind of knowledge gets shared, right, when you disclose a patent, and what kind of knowledge is retained as tech, as trade secret. So one of the amazing things about the biotech industry, right, which of course sits even in that name, like at that bridge of pharmaceuticals and technology, and helps us understand that really they become inseparable. But what makes it so hard to produce a generic version of a biotech drug right now? It's not just that these molecules are bigger or that the science to do them is more complex. It's also that we've created a set of statutes in which one doesn't need to disclose all of the relevant bits of knowledge involved in making them to get a patent, right? That we allow both the pharmaceutical industry and the biotech industry, and increasingly, right, parts of big tech, especially infotech industry, to kind of reserve all of this stuff as trade secret rather than disclosing it. So part of a social critique of technology is refusing to accept these as natural distinctions, or refusing to accept them as distinctions that you need to be an expert in any of these fields to understand. But to actually see that mystification itself as a political maneuver that actually helps to defend the interests of these industries, and that there's actually a space of meaningful political potential in which one can say, well, no, we actually shouldn't allow all these things to be trade secrets. And then the question is, well, how does one actually generate the action to transform that playing field? But these are kinds of questions that if you don't open up the social space of technology, we don't even learn to see that these are actually political fields that we should be working in.
Thank you for that, Dr. Segway. At it again. That was perfect. Thank you for elaborating. This is perhaps obvious, but it's something that we ask all of our guests and is an opportunity to put a somewhat of a finer point on this connection. How does your historical work, how does it help us think about debates, problems, and or practices in medicine today?
So that's not a small question. I think that I'm interested in this a couple of different levels, right? On the one hand, our conversation has been leaning into the political and leaning into the policy space. So what is the role of a historian of medicine, like me or like the two of you, in engaging with meaningful policy change? And sometimes it could be as simple as testifying to the fact that what we think of as a space of political possibility today is really a snapshot of a deeply contracted moment of a much larger historical array of social and political possibilities, many of which are just automatically taken off the table by a failure of historical imagination to go back beyond 10 years. So, you know, if you look at the work I did for my second book on generic drugs, right, part of what interests me so much in looking at the moment in which the generic drug comes into being, right, as a kind of a way of having a cheaper version of the older off-patent brand name drug that sort of gives the access part to this balance of access and innovation in American pharmaceutical policy, is realizing that so many people in the policy space just believe that you can either have access or innovation, right? Or that you have to protect the intellectual property in a new drug by allowing high prices to exist on a monopoly basis in order to incentivize further innovation. But then after a little bit of time passes, that patent will expire. And then once it becomes an off-patent drug, then many competitors should jump in and that free market competition will produce accessibility. And realizing that both elements of this equation are kind of naturalizing a certain aura of capitalistic assumptions, right? Both in incentivizing innovation, that you need incentive for innovation. And if there's not a tremendous amount of profit to be made off of a discovery, then no one's going to discover anything. And that, you know, that's a very interesting thing to assume is true, right? And then on the other hand, assuming that the way to make access possible is to have free market competition by a lot of different parties of something that is off patent. But then this whole thing gets built into sort of a naturalization. You know, this all takes shape roughly in the mid-1980s, the bill called the Hatch-Waxman Amendment, which really is a handshake between Henry Waxman leading the Liberal Democratic contingent, which was helping to represent the generic drug firms, and Orrin Hatch, Republican senator in Utah, you know, leading this contingent representing the brand name, you know, pharma firms. And this is a deal which is celebrated as this incredible bipartisan piece of legislation, but it created a whole bunch of fictions because we know that old drugs aren't necessarily cheap, right? Generic things don't necessarily spring into being. Nor is it simply the case that because something is a new drug, does it mean that it's worth sentencing those who can't afford it but would otherwise benefit it to not have access to it. Right. So there's so much that gets mystified and pushed behind the curtains when we celebrate something like the Hatch-Waxman Act. I'm not saying it didn't do incredible good in the world. Right. I mean, we can calculate the, you know, trillions of dollars saved and the people who've been able to get medicine otherwise wouldn't have because of the creation of this robust generic drug industry. But it's just other things get baked into that pie. Right. If you look back a little bit further, right, if you get back to the late 1950s, and you find this moment where Estes Kefauver is this senator leading a set of investigations into monopoly power in the United States and sees the pharmaceutical industry as the most robust sort of stage to actually set the moral stakes of a fight over monopoly power in the United States, and holds these televised hearings and comes up with the bill at the end of it that basically suggests, you know, a drug company should only get a patent if it can show its drug is better than existing therapies. And no pharmaceutical patent should last more than 3 years. And that the patent office and the FDA should be involved in proactively making sure that the American consumer gets the best deal possible all the time. Now, you know, this is what Kefauver put forward in 1961 when he put forward his bill. It didn't pass, right? It didn't go down that way. But almost no person in Capitol Hill right now remembers that, right? And the fact that Kefauver was a centrist Democrat, you know, a proposal like that right now would get most people laughed out of a room, Capitol Hill. And so part of the value of history is in recuperating these past political possibilities. And what has changed between Kefauver's moment and our own is not really a kind of a scientific or technological transformation in these spaces, right? But it is a sort of a inertia of entrenched power and naturalization of things like the expected patent life of a drug or things like the expected lobbying power of the pharmaceutical industry that then help to reshape what our limits of the possible are. So part of history in the engagement of policy of, you know, when I find myself traveling to Capitol Hill to talk to congressional staffers is just to remember just how meager our possible solution space is compared to larger space.
It's really interesting what you're saying about, you know, history reminding us that things or ideas and politics have not always been the same as they are now. I mean, Mary made really similar points in her podcast episode about abortion before Roe, saying like the reasons that abortion was problematized or fought back against in previous decades, centuries, et cetera, was not the same reasons that it's problematized now. And lots of times it's so difficult to get yourself out of the present day. So I really appreciate you pulling that thread to your work as well. Less smooth of a segue.
For but, once.
But we've been talking a lot about the history of medicine as well as the history of technology, but you're also a key component in the Center for Medical Humanities and Social Medicine here at Hopkins, which of course, you know, is kind of the support and the avenue for this podcast. So we were wondering if we could talk a bit about medical humanities as a field and what you see the relationship between the history of medicine and medical humanities, and how you think of yourself as working within the medical humanities as a field adjacent to or overlapping with the history of medicine.
Or like we could also mention social medicine in conjunction with the medical humanities.
Yeah, no, thanks for those questions. You know, and it's interesting because medical humanities means so many things and it can get so many people excited, which always surprises me because it comes across constantly as a novel field, but it's been around a long time, right? And there's a tight history of the role of history in the medical humanities, which is not to say that we need to claim all of it, right? Medical humanities, I think it's wonderful that the concept is as flexible as it is, right? And can embrace so many different disciplinary positions. And, you know, I think one of just many possible origin stories that works here at Hopkins is this concern that as physicians in the you know, original faculty at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine work to try and imagine a new, more scientific mode of medical training, that the Hopkins brand becomes very tightly identified with, you know, well before the Flexner Report, but certainly after, right? That there's already built into that this concern that, well, what if medicine is reduced to a technical practice? Or what if caregiving is just reduced to just these sort of scientific formulations? And this cannot be allowed to happen. And this is certainly part of why our own department here, the Institute of History of Medicine, when you founded in 1929, it's the first institute of its kind in the English-speaking world, is founded, you know, by William Henry Welch, right, the first dean of the School of Medicine himself, right, sort of an ardent champion of this new, like, intensely scientific grounding of medical training, but based on this concern that a school like Hopkins had to also invest in the human qualities of caregiving. Now, those human qualities were tied up with a lot of other assumptions as well, right? Especially at Johns Hopkins, you know, classist, often white supremacist, right? So, you know, we can get into the limiting strictures that medical humanities in that sense could also be a retreat to a certain kind of gentleman physician. And so for Welch, it was actually history that was the most important and readily available humanistic discipline that could help ground humility as well as a broader sense of empathy, you know, in the training of physicians. And I think this happened a lot of other places around the country and around the world. I think that part of the caution of the breadth of the term medical humanities is that it can be used in very classist ways, right? Like if medical humanities means that one goes to art museums and symphonies in order to be the kind of person that goes to art museums and symphonies, then it can recapitulate the class expectations of medicine just as much as some of the dress codes and professionalisms can. But if medical humanities really takes on the critical edge of what humanities disciplines themselves do, which is to say, you know, and it's hard to say, well, what is the one thing that humanities do, right? But I think one area of common ground is in the space of criticism, and criticism not as a negative thing, right? But criticism being engaging with a process of defamiliarizing, right? Making the unfamiliar familiar and the familiar unfamiliar, using modes of analysis to actually ground and contextualize and ask, why does something have the power that it does at a certain moment in time, right? And what other elements of power are working in that space? Or to look at the problems of meaning, right? And the problems of crafting narratives and the structures that go into understanding, you know, how we value what we value and how we devalue what we learn to discard. So The problem I have with medical humanities is not humanities, right? But it's oftentimes how it is that a kind of a facile form can actually be kind of pernicious or even romantic or revanchist or retrogressive, right? Like there are definitely approaches to medical humanities that are really actually complaints of how we lost the old ways that we once had. And historians, that's not the point of doing history, right? It's not really about a nostalgic loss. It's about how do we actually use the critical perspectives that we develop to actually engage more with the lives that we have in the present. So that's a long answer for you, but a different way of answering it would be to say, if we were just to boil humanities down to one single thing that all humanities disciplines did, we'll be missing the specific kinds of methods and tools and theories that different humanities disciplines bring to the problem of thinking about health and medicine. I mean, Christy, you're trained as an art historian. So there are modes of analysis that come second nature to you about how to think with the visual and how to think with media, right? Which are not at all necessarily the same as someone who learns narrative medicine is going to work off of, or not necessarily the same as someone who's an intellectual historian would actually work off of either. The question I have for medical humanities is, how do you build the space in which different people and in different medical spaces, working with whatever particular strengths they have, can actually come together to build an effective network for thinking about the importance of the social world in healing spaces?
I've been noticing in the last couple of years, a lot more people are saying, instead of, oh yeah, I work within the medical humanities or my research is in the medical humanities, they are defining themselves as working within the critical medical humanities because they see that as an important distinction.
It's a really good term. And then one of the challenges, though, becomes, well, we were, when we first founded the Center for Medical Humanities and Social Medicine, and this social medicine gets to your point, Antoine, and we'll come back to what that means and why it's so important to tether these two together in terms of the kind of style of medical humanities we've developed here at Johns Hopkins. But, you know, we were first going to call it a Center for Critical Medicine. And, you know, I pitched that to a few people who are doing work in critical medical humanities. They're like, yes, of course, critical. Yeah, medical humanities need to be critical. And then when I pitched that to folks in the School of Medicine, I would get one of two responses. They either say like, oh, so, okay, so you're going to be in ICUs, right? And so, because of course, like Center for Critical Medicine sounds a lot for the Center for Critical Care Medicine. I totally get that slippage, right? But then the other one was just like, well, why do you hate medicine, right? And this is one of the problems of translating what critique is, right? And what it means to engage in criticism and what that word comes to mean in sort of broader American usage. So we actually deliberately chose medical humanities because we realized that when sympathetic folks across different spaces of medicine, public health, nursing, right, wanted to think about the broader social world and the sort of power relations that existed within meaning-making apparatus, that this concept of medical humanities was a bucket term that they wanted to invest that in. So rather than actually take the more specific term, which meant something to us, but not to anybody else, we realized, well, you know, we're already going to work together, right? But if we can create this space that is meaningful to other people and then help show them what medical humanities can be when it becomes critical. And that's actually where social medicine came in for us, right? Because the practice of social medicine, which has its own set of histories, right? And of course, is not limited to humanities, right? It involves many different social science fields, right? You know, so sociology, anthropology, some political science, some, you know, epidemiology, sometimes economics, right? But one of the elements of social medicine is always trying to think about the social world, the milieu in which care takes place, and how it could be focused more directly towards helping create better care and more equitable care systems. So by tethering medical humanities to social medicine, we both kind of create a broader tent, but also at the same time, if we focus on that linkage all of the time, the critical is already there.
You said something that stood out to me, too, that the problem with medical humanities isn't necessarily the humanities. And that's the point that Keith Whalew made in his article, Patients Are Humans, Too, The Emergence of Medical Humanities. But also that's a decent segue into our next question where, and mentioning Whalew, if I'm not mistaken, both of you were trained by the great Charles Rosenberg.
you're sketching out a kinship structure that, yes, we definitely share that.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so that's why we were curious. Who are some scholars who have, you know, vitally influenced your work within the medical humanities and the history of medicine? And who are some emerging scholars who you're looking forward to, you know, reading more of and engaging their work?
Yeah, thanks for that question. And but again, here you've taken the segue in this point, because I would start with Keith as someone, and I mean, listen, I owe a lot of scholarly debts, both in terms of folks within the medical world who in my training were sort of primed to understand and appreciate the social as a valid category of inquiry within biomedical spaces. And so there I would mention, among others, you know, the late Paul Farmer, who as a physician anthropologist, Paul is part of the reason I started medical school as well. I had met him and started corresponding with him, actually this just right after I left college and took a job working in health policy. And it was actually in continuing to read his work and corresponding with him that I decided to think about this space between history, as I mentioned before, medical anthropology, and what it meant to be a joint physician scholar in the social sciences and humanities. And you know, Paul, for listeners who don't know, was a, you know, physician anthropologist who, among other things, founded an organization, co-founded, called Partners in Health, that was dedicated to using models of accompagnatorship and equal partnership with communities, you know, beginning in central Haiti and extending to Peru and to Siberia and Rwanda and, you know, Boston and Chiapas in Mexico and many other places in between, to think about how open-ended and engaged social critique could lead towards producing a preferential option for the poor, and to thinking about the depth of structural determinants of health as, and you know, dealing with, you know, steep indices of poverty, almost naturalized senses of difference, as nonetheless malleable. And so for Paul, thinking about medicine in a biosocial framework, meaning thinking about social medicine, always having a binocular vision of what is the history and also the sort of economic and social embeddedness of a practice, and what do we take for granted and what can we change? So there's constantly in that interface this sense that being a committed clinician and a committed social scientist could actually lead to meaningful change in the world. So Paul's inspired a lot of people. And also inspires a kind of a Paul Farmer complex in almost any of his trainees, which is that no one can be Paul Farmer, right? But we can certainly be appreciative to have learned from his example and friendship. And obviously, since Paul passed away unexpectedly earlier this year, I still haven't processed the loss, but it's helped me become more aware of just, you know, how very fortunate I was to have such a model and a friend. But, you know, you mentioned Keith Whalew, and Keith's a great person to think with as well. And I like that. In, you know, invoking this kinship model in which, you know, both Keith and I were trained by Charles Rosenberg and have this substantial scholarly debt to him, of course, as well. And, you know, I think both Keith and I also had, say, you know, Alan Brandt is very important colleagues early in our careers as well. And so I could start listing the acknowledgement sections from my books here as well. But the reason it's helpful to think with Keith is that Keith is somebody who, you know, in addition to just doing really sparkling scholarship on non-obvious intersections of health in the social world with every subsequent book he produces, finds his questions in pragmatic experiences and in asking questions about oftentimes relatively mundane and taken for granted things, and then showing how with a careful historicization and really following through the actors without having a prejudged story ahead of time, right, can bring a reader along to a more complex understanding of a world, and a world with sites of actions in which we don't need to take the status quo as inevitable. And so Keith has shown, I think, many of us paths in which doing history can engage materially and immediately with the policy world, but also paths in which doing history simply to tell the story so that there is a continued bearing witness has its own meanings. So I'm, you know, very thankful to have had Keith's, you know, mentorship and guidance throughout my career as well. I can't answer your question about promising younger scholars simply because there are too many I'm so excited about the future of this field, but I'm excited also because the future of this field doesn't exist in any one space. Right? Like, what makes history of medicine a vibrant space to be in? It's not because like there's some gatekeeping that needs to happen of the appropriate way of being a historian of medicine or kind of coming out of the right history of medicine PhD program. And so I do feel like, especially in recent years, there's a lot of methodologies. A lot's been coming from Latin American studies. There's a lot of energy and enthusiasm coming from East Asian studies. I mean, we can kind of move geographically around the world. But also thinking about an event that just last month at the Center for Africana Studies, in which Sadia Hartman was speaking about her trilogy, right? And just thinking about the methodological challenge that comes, right, with engaging with critical fabulation, right? And to the extent to which a field like history of medicine has only really begun to engage with the possibilities and responsibilities that exist in that space, right? And these are linkages that one might argue could and should have been happening a while ago. And I think there's many, if you think about the branching tree of historiography, and then it's as important for looking at the kind of negative spaces where things haven't developed as the spaces that have developed. But I think in my role these days as the editor of the Bulletin of History of Medicine, rather than being a gatekeeper, I feel like our responsibility is to actually help to think about those kinds of intersections of history of medicine and other modes of scholarship that aren't happening yet. But I'd say every graduate student I work with, right, challenges me to learn new methods and theories that then wind up impacting my work. And that's partly why we're lucky to get to teach and work with younger scholars.
Great. Of course, we know that we're both on the list, but... No. I'm sorry. Okay. But, you mentioned there younger scholars or other scholars are helping you think through new intersections between the history of medicine and other fields that haven't been done yet. So in that vein of things, we want to wrap up with just one last question. What you're working on next and what you're excited about and what your next project might be, post the doctor who wasn't there.
So now we're talking trash, right? Because I've gotten very interested in what we discard. And I don't know if you've had a chance to see a book recently written by Max Laborion and Josh Leposky called Discard Studies, but it's a beautiful small book that is a entry point into what they're positing as a new field of discard studies, in which they're suggesting it's not enough to study trash or waste, but that if we're thinking about the ecological consequences of what we throw away, but we only see it at the point of throwing away, we miss all of the residues of our pollution are effectively tied into systems of power and decision-making, things that get built into the technologies that are or are not biodegradable or reusable. In other words, that discard is a system of power. This is a very slim book that they've written, but it's very approachable, and it's something that cuts across many different humanistic disciplines, many different, methodologies. But I've become really interested in why we've built a disposable empire within biomedical spaces. Because again, as with the forgetting that we've already done of prior possibilities of thinking about the drug industry just barely more than a half century ago, most medical technologies are built to be reused. Laboratory equipment, syringes, even blood containers or glass containers. We needed to develop the flexible plastic blood bag that got thrown away before we could produce that form of garbage. And so as a practitioner, I've been shocked actually at even in the past decade, how many things that used to be reusable even 10 years ago in my clinic are now disposable. And what's interesting is this accelerating vector of disposability comes at exactly the moment in which the extensive carbon footprint of the healthcare sector, right? You may know this already, but if the global healthcare sector was a country, it would have the fifth largest carbon footprint of the world, right? And that we give medicine a pass. And carbon only tells part of the story, right? Because that assumes every kind of waste is fungible. And we know that plastics are not fungible, right? They just continue. They either sort of float on the surface of the ocean, or they're incinerated and they wind up being one of the leading causes of, you know, respiratory ailments. And so plastics are a real problem and they're not necessary. And yet we give healthcare a pass when it comes to disposability because it's assumed that, well, it's a trade-off between sort of an ecological consequence and a safety consequence, especially in the wake of COVID-19, which amplified, right, dramatically amplified this problem of single-use medical devices just clotting up landfills and washing ashore on beaches. And we've all gotten used to seeing one of the physical imprints of the COVID-19 pandemic has been just seeing masks at the side of the road, right, everywhere, or even the kind of Binax test kit popsicle, which was meant to be used once and then tossed away and discarded. The thing is that we make disposability into a virtue, right? We make it into virtue in both clinical medicine and in global health, where so many elements of global health engineering kits are about designing disposable kits that can go anywhere. But then once they're used, they just simply are another form of refuse. So one of the questions of this project is, well, how and why did we decide to valorize disposability? And was it ever actually proven that disposability was necessary for safety? Or was the rise of a shift to disposable objects? And I'm especially interested in the disposable syringe, which is, I think, iconic in a way for what medical waste becomes, the plastic syringe. Was it actually simply that these things were successfully sold based on notions of fear and efficiency, right? Because 60 years ago, a glass syringe is sterilized in a hospital autoclave or a clinic autoclave and reused. And it's sterilized and reused safely. But we've got a couple things in the interim. I mean, we could talk about the AIDS epidemic, right? And the different kinds of fears mobilized there. We could talk about hepatitis, you know. We could talk about stigmas, especially with syringes associated with drug use and kind of the moralization of the syringe as well. But we also really should talk about labor, right? Because what happens in hospital management is that even without there being any proof that a disposable syringe is actually any safer than a reusable glass one, is that when you have a reusable glass one, you need to not only have this, you know, centralized resource of an autoclave to sterilize it, but you need people to do that work, right? You need labor, and you need skilled labor, and you need to value them. And when you shift to disposable systems, all you have to deal with is a supply chain. And so in many ways, the shift from reusable or a circular economy of medical technology to disposable or a linear economy of medical technology could have as much or more to do with efficient management of things instead of people as it does with any real claim to necessity or public health safety. And that's the riddle, I think, at the center of the work I'm doing right now, is to understand how we got sold on this system. And what we can do to actually get back towards a circular economy in healthcare.
Amazing. Well, that does it for all of our questions. We want to thank you for your time and your generosity. And I did just want to say, you know, before we head on out, speaking of disposability, your New York Jets, if they lose one more game.
I know. I'm going to ride this year, Antoine.
Who are you telling? I have this small light of hope, whereas the Raiders make the playoffs. Oh. Well, but thank you so much. This was amazing. Really enjoyed this conversation.